I think it's hardly possible that anyone in this room doesn't already have a copy of Rick St. John's The Pure Inconstancy of Grace, The Pure Inconstancy of Grace. But if you do not have a copy, you should really be sure you get one tonight, because this is a great book. And I really, and there's this wonderful book called Shrine, Chapel 2. The Pure Inconstancy of Grace was published in 2005 by Truman State University Press, and as the first runner-up in the 2004 T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry. The poem Shrine was released by Finishing Line Press in March of 2011. Rick St. John's work has appeared in Swanee Review, Poet Lore, Carolina Quarterly, and many other periodicals and anthologies that occasionally I can state correctly. Rick has degrees in English from Princeton University and University of Virginia, and he completed a mid-career Loeb Fellowship at Harvard University when I was just first starting to write, and was doing all this work with sort of personal and historical poems. Michael Worcester said to me, "You know, you ought to let Rick see these things, and he'll have a few pointers for you," and he did. Thank heavens. It's with great pleasure that I introduce my great friend, Rick St. John.
Well, thank you to Joan and to Jimmy for organizing, and all of you for coming out. And it's a delight to just be reading with such three close friends this evening, all of whom are just fine poets and also very different poets, so it's great. I'm just going to read two poems this evening. The first one is new and short, and I'm just going to kind of try it out on you and see what you make of it, because you're such a wonderful audience. And it's set in a congressional office, and it has a little epigraph from the Gospel of Luke. Called Maria's Song, and the epigraph is, "He hath put down the mighty from their seats." An old story. The girl was pregnant, had spent the night on the streets of Washington. It looked like she'd come for a green card, or maybe to get warm and to sneak our office bathroom. We never do this, but I let her in. "I'm here to see my aunt. She works to keep clean this building." "They're only here at night," I explained. But there was something luminous about her. Even the congressman saw it as he passed through. She was crying then, but when she calmed, we sent her down with an aide and pass to peek for a moment into the chambers. But she didn't stop at the parted door. She must have seen her aunt cleaning something spilled in the west aisle. And who could have guessed? The timid girl barreled right in, with a host of house guards scurrying behind. They paused, though, the human weight of it, as the two embraced. And that's when, I'm told, the girl broke into a crazed, magnificent song. This second poem is a long one, and it's in a lot of short parts. It's called Shrine, and it was recently released as a chapbook from Finishing Line. I'm going to thank you in advance for kind of doing the hard work of following along with a long poem. This one takes place in Japan. I was traveling there with a friend who was giving a presentation, a big presentation in Hiroshima, and I was giving a very small presentation. The two main characters are my wife, Kate, who's a self-trained naturalist and bird watcher, and she wasn't on the trip, and also our young Japanese translator and guide. So this poem is kind of about our choices, our vows, our moral commitments. You know, do our individual choices really make a difference or not? What's the intersection between our sort of personal lives and our sort of the kind of larger social sphere? And our moral obligations, whether they're kind of political or personal, Are they like heavy weights that we carry around all the time, or might they be something different? So the poem starts with a little epigraph from William James, a philosopher who said, you know, we live in a world of uncertainties. He calls it a world of maybes. And when we pick one or interpret one in one way or instead of another, we kind of help create a different universe. Shrine. And here's the epigraph from James. You make one or the other of two possible universes, true, by your trust or mistrust. Both only maybes until you contributed your act. The first thing you do on entering a shrine is to pause at the rough stone trough. In your left hand, take the wooden wand that ends in a metal cup. Scoop some water onto your right, then repeat the gestures opposite. Pour the clear water in your palm. Taste, but don't swallow. Cleanse your mouth. Last, raise up the dented cup and let a little stream run down along the handle where you touched it last. Beautiful, and yet what made it even then a little holy, made my pulse beat fast, was Neriko, the way she taught me this. Did I bring something less than pure, a lack, a longing when I came? I remember on the plane, drowsing in the cabin's undetermined light, and as a benediction, trying to recall Kate's face. 30 years together, yet I couldn't quite. Only through a phonograph I summoned up from early in our marriage. Kate, with friends outside a churchyard door, lovely, laughing, throwing rice, and blurred. So, guided by my Japanese interpreter to a carved stone incense urn, I really meant my prayer. As the families came in turn, the grandma cupping smoke to her aching arm, a father with his son before the school exams, wafting the pungent air from the glowing charcoal to the boy's dark hair. I brought the inchoate but sharp blue smoke toward the left breast pocket of the coat I wore, wishing for something like a more capacious heart. The paper cranes lie strewn in brightly colored heaps at the base of every monument in Hiroshima. They come each year, flown in from tender-hearted student teachers and their students, wishing peace at Booker Elementary in St. Boniface. Neriko's mother went to grade school in an L-shaped building that survived the blast. Her teachers told the class that when they swam along the river and they found a skull, not to let it pass. They should bring it out. Now, everywhere, the skulls mount up. So much for folding cranes, for heart. It's the heart, though, that moves us, heavy bodies through each day for good or ill, systole, diastole. The plosive moment comes to us anew 60 times or so each minute, more in childhood or in high emotion, stress. Diastole, relax. In the Memorial Museum shop, Neriko points out a book she read in childhood. Two cartoon kids play pranks and catch big fish. Then comes the flash. Then the page is full of smoke and loss. She brushes her fingertips across the thin book's face to bring it closed. Who is Neriko? Classically trained in song, her accent Canadian. At Hiroshima Station, there to send us off, she gets a call from our next stop, informing her they have no translator. No bag, no place to stay. She gets her tickets, laughs. We're on our way. Kyoto. When I try to interpret her for you, I hear that phrase, that tone. Not just a bird-like song, but this, some lilt, some generous lightness of foot that's wholly requisite in all, the best translation, yet a gift. Something moved my wife to fly, clear to Nebraska, to see the sandhill cranes gleaning corn by the wide River Platte, on their long journey north to Alaska and beyond. Back home, Kate described them, her voice even then a bit a tremble, the way they rise as individuals, but more, emotion, one explosive shudder in the sky. Pointless to wonder, do they make a difference, doing what they do, only going the way they need to go? A gift that I brought back for Kate, a scarf of cranes, is something Nerico found. How strange this dusty purple and this olive green would seem so perfect here. Sometimes the snowy wings appear as delicate and artful as a Kano screen. I almost hear the flutes and drums where Nerico was trained. Other times, they rise abruptly from real fields, passionate reminders of real birds. Kate's world, so passionate and practical and clear. I want to know whose birds they are. A little peck last night in bed. All those years we've been best friends, Kate whispers. So it is, yes, friends. Friendship, no small thing. Season by season, the graceful calligraphy of locust leaves settling through sky, the paper thin unfolding unexpectedly again in spring. Leaves layering leaves, becoming loam, becoming bedrock over time. Nerico explained she planned to stay through March, perhaps till May, to watch the cherry blossoms come again. I'm late autumn, and a light dusting of white begins to frost the edges of my hair. I guess it made me faintly ghostly and avuncular to her. Tonight, in lamplight, memories of fiery maples, wing-like shrines. 8 days, like overflowing water through my hands. We barely touched. One chaste hug at the departure gate, and once, near a shrine, I stumbled back. She caught me sliding downward on a gravel path. My last evening in Japan, the road we walked curved steeply down a wooded valley. Pale light still hung above the mountainside, beneath deep indigo. Behind low courtyard screens, the shadowy persimmon trees, their fruit, round globes like lanterns, caught or else gave off, like breath, the last late light. Sweet or tart, the lingering glow of simply paying close attention, being paid attention to. Once, while on the train, Nerico had idly handed me a tiny silver crane folded from a foil wrapper, which I stuck inside the pages of my book. 3 months later, when I check, it's gone. It must have fluttered off while reading on the bus or with Kate some weekend, getting groceries, doing chores. She taught me, Nerico, a poem that every school child learns. Although I did not bring the whisk, the proper cleansing offering, still the red leaves settle on this stream. Nerico had volunteered for weeks to aid survivors of the Kobe earthquake. Later, her Toronto choir had sung Stabat Mater, Dvorak's work, begun the year he'd quickly lost his daughter, then 2 sons. Her conductor, every night, had told them, Sing like you are crying. The voices in the darkened concert hall took flight. On our street, I find a fallen thrush. I pick it up, stunned by how light it is. One wing unfolds beneath my hand, intricate and patterned as a paper fan. It seems to hold all the unequal losses of the world. Today I walk to work. The willows by the river stand knee-high in fast brown water, along with their reflections, blurred and dim. Two potential worlds of maybe water, maybe sky. Perhaps my feet that move along the bridge, across the street, help turn the turning deeply sundered earth. I'm turning in my currency. The dour cashier observes, there's not much here. I unfold my last 1,000 yen and dump my pocket change. On the bill, two cranes pose formally across an oval watermark, the ghostly image of an emperor. They face each other, floating wings unfurled in mysterious salute or ancient ritual. Every August 6th, toward night, the citizens of Hiroshima light 1,000 paper lanterns, which they set upon the river in hope that all the troubled spirits might find rest. The little boats float out, float out. They glimmer in the dark. Then the restless sea winds blow them back. At one Buddha site, I saw an iron staff and shoes, impossible to lift, an obligation carried daily by initiates, first down, then up the cedar-sided mountain to the shrine. But now I call to mind an old monk, poised, his sable brush above white page. First, he blesses breath. He blesses those who breathe. He blesses all the innocents. Blesses paper. Blesses rice that made it. Blesses brush. He next dips gently in dark sky. The ink, one fluid motion he's been practicing for 50 years. A darkened wing or foliage? Now a downstroke, sinuous but sturdy like a tree. The tree, in turn, supported from below by yet another gesture, grass or stone or water, I don't know. But I can see his generous attention makes it so. I slowly draw in breath. I try to hold the brush, as all the while I also let it go. I bless. Steady as I can, I set the ink to paper, practicing. I want to learn the sign for bird, for breath, for leaf. Outside my window, patchy snow and muddy green footprints. No maples and no stream, just the street I've chosen. Shrine of guardrail, winter litter, paper brush and brightly colored cans. And this, our little stand of locusts, gnarly urban trees, about to shiver into leaf again. And thanks.